This is Day to Day. I'm Madeline Brand.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. Richard Marinick has been a Massachusetts state trooper, a mob enforcer, and an armed robber, for which he went to prison for 10 years. After he got out, Marinick published Boyos in 2004, a highly acclaimed novel that drew on his life as a wise guy in the South Boston criminal underworld. Now Marinick has written a second novel, In for a Pound. It tells the story of Delray McCauley, a former state trooper who went to prison and then struggles to get his life back together when he gets out. Last week, I walked with Marinick through South Boston, which provides the setting for his novel.
This neighborhood has changed a lot, Anthony. It's not the neighborhood that I knew. It's not the neighborhood 20 years ago or for 50 years ago, whatever it was. South Boston was the last bastion of the Irish mob in America, and it was thriving here up until about 15 years ago. I wanted to weave something from my experience there into this book, In for a Pound. So a state trooper coming back to his roots in South Boston after serving a prison term, I knew about that, okay? And that's where the idea came from primarily.
The Irish mob no longer owns these streets, but there are plenty of landmarks from the old days. Marinick points out where Triple O's used to be, the restaurant that was headquarters for the notorious mob boss James Whitey Bulger.
He had an office right above the place. He had a probably what you might call a torturous chamber down in the basement. He used to bring people down there, kill them, take them out the back door. There's at least a couple people they took out of there.
Marinick's novel, like much of his life, is set in a world where the lines between the cops and the cons, the legal and the illegal, are often blurry. His fictional mob boss, Jack Wacko Curran, is modeled on the real James Whitey Bulger, who was not only a ruthless gangster, but also an FBI informant. Today he's on the run, wanted for murder, racketeering, and extortion. Bulger is also known for this. His brother is the former state Senate president, William Bulger, for years a major force in state politics.
He was a loved political over here. People loved him, came out in droves to vote for him. If Jimmy was his brother, Whitey was his brother, how could Whitey be really that bad? And if he was bad, well, he was probably more like a Robin Hood type character. That was the legend that followed Jimmy Bulger around in South Boston. But since he went on the run, a lot of information has come out. He was a drug dealer, he was a murderer. But you get the hardcore cadre that still supports both brothers, saying, no, it couldn't have been that way.
You know, I did some interviews on the street here when he disappeared, and I found some elderly people who didn't strike me as gangsters, but they said things like, when he was around, this neighborhood was safe.
Fact.
I mean, there was sort of this idea that he looked out for his own and he made this place safe.
I agree with that. I mean, in those days, the neighborhood was safe. You had the Irish mob element. You had the gangsters roaming around here. But you didn't have junkies breaking into houses. You did not have people getting mugged in the street, period. It didn't happen. If Mrs. O'Malley has got a group of kids, teenagers, loud and boisterous on her corner, keeping her up at night, everybody in Southie knew someone in those days. She'd make a phone call. It would eventually get back to Jimmy Bulger or one of his lieutenants, and they'd send someone like myself down there, my friends. We'd go down to the corner. You get one warning.
So you had your own crew here.
Yeah.
You had interaction with Jimmy Bulger,
right,
with Whitey Bulger. What was he like? I mean,
Jimmy Bulger was steely-eyed businessman, number one, and a cold-blooded murderer, number two.
And that came across when you looked at him?
There was no doubt. He had these eyes that told you, and he had this persona. People will hit you with the aura. This guy pounded you with his aura. You had no doubt when you were dealing with Jimmy Bulger that he would, in fact, kill you if you crossed him. And it happened to me once. I can't go into what I wanted to do. And he told me straight up I'd end up in the trunk of his car.
Now, this theme of this thin line that sort of separates the legal from the illegal, from people who go straight. You were a state cop.
Right.
What happened? Why did you cross that line?
I wasn't patient. I wanted things that I couldn't afford. I was putting a lot of hours in. I wasn't making any money. I looked at my friends over here in Southie, what they had. These are the gangsters. And finally, I said, I had enough. I fell back in with my friends over here, and things just progressed from there.
You know, there was the movie Goodfellas by Scorsese. I thought painted this great image of what attracts young people into leading this kind of wise guy life. And who could resist that? I mean, was that true to life?
A lot of it, absolutely. When I worked in the combat zone years ago as a 19-year-old kid, it was completely dominated by the mafia, the Boston Mafia, La Cosa Nostra in those days. And I'd see the wise guys coming in, and they'd have the beautiful Armani suits on, they'd have the Piaget watches, the beautiful women on their arms, and I saw the respect that these people got from everybody. And I said, geez, maybe I can do that. But I became a cop eventually. I got away from that, and that didn't work out. I said, well, maybe I can try the other side. And I became very proficient at it for a number of years.
So for a number of years, you ran an armed robbery gang. And then what, in 1986, you tried to do what you hope would be your last hit.
You'd like to say this is the last one, one more big one, you know. And we had whacked an armored car out in Williamstown, the western part of the state. And we got caught. We got caught in a roadblock, and it wasn't my day. And I was caught, and I was sentenced to 18 to 20, along with my Confederates. I ended up doing the 18 to 20, and I got out in about 10 and a half years.
So what went on in prison? Is that, first of all, is that where the writing bug infected you?
No, I've been a writer. I think I was born to write. I was writing even when I was a gangster, when I was running the streets over here. In between scores, I'd be writing. When I was in prison, I decided through the Boston University Prison Education Program, I get fully involved in that. I had a lot of encouragement from my various professors who believed in me, and which made me believe in me.
Let's say that last armored truck heist had gone the way you had planned.
Right.
Where do you think you'd be now?
I'd probably either be dead or in the feds right now. There was an armored car depository out there. That was the next thing we were thinking about hitting. While we were in prison, I was in about a year and a half, and another segment of my crew hit it. And they got almost $4 million. And they got caught 3 years later, and they're doing 35 to 40-year prison federal sentences right now. So that's what it was, you know. It wasn't meant to be, you know. My time was up.
You know, these two books, Boyo's and In for a Pound, I gather they're based on stuff that, you know, really happened, that you
sure
witnessed. Some people are going to look at this kind of literature and say, hey, you know, you're profiting from crimes and from stuff that hurt people. And what do you say to that criticism?
What does Raymond Chandler, Elmore Leonard, Dennis Lehane, Robert Parker do? I mean, it's the same thing. I'm a convicted felon, my next crime, you know. I've changed my life. I've paid my debt to society. I spent my time in prison. I give back. I work in a county jail. I'm a reentry instructor. I run groups in the prison, in the jail, with guys transitioning back into society, run groups in life skills, creative writing, advanced creative writing, poetry, substance abuse, anger management. I'm in there helping. I'm making nickels doing this. You don't get paid well, but it's something that I want to do.
Tell me about that. I mean, it seems like you have something particular to offer these guys.
I have validity. I mean, to offer. I have experience. I've been where they're at. What I do and what I say carries a little bit more weight, let's put it that way.
What do you tell them?
I tell them that there's a lot of negativity in jail, a lot of negativity in state prison. You get people telling them all the time, you're going to get out, you're not going to be able to make it. You're going to have to go back to the old life. No one's going to want you. And I tell them that you can get a job, you can work, you can change your life, you can move forward in a positive way. You can do good things, you know? And there's people out there willing to help you if you're willing to help yourself.
Are you able also to tell them that there are going to be sort of influences out there that are going to try to pull you back in? And I'm just wondering if you felt that since you've been out.
Absolutely. I was heavily recruited when I came out of prison. Good help is hard to find, just like in any profession. And I was considered good help. And the temptations there, you know, it's nice to be asked, Anthony. It's nice to be asked. But you know what? I'd always say no, because I could see where it was going to take me.
Well, Richard, thanks so much. What a pleasure.
Anthony, thank you, sir.
Appreciate it.
Okay.
That's Richard Marinick. His new novel is called In for a Pound, and you can find an excerpt from the book on our website, npr.org.